Good evening. I would like to call the House Ways and Means Committee to order. Today's March 27th, 2023. Let the record reflect that it is 6 p.m. Today we have present Speaker Tilton, Representative McKay, Representative McCabe, Representative Groh, Representative Gray, and myself, Chair Carpenter. And I would like to let the record reflect also that we have Senator Myers here with us. Thank you for being with us. Let's remind the committee members and those in the audience to silence your cell phones. We have Kevin Allen with House Records and Zachary Lawhorn with LIO. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here to help with us tonight. My staff, Kendra Broussard, will be the committee aide. We have two items on the agenda this evening. Today we will have a presentation from the Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League, Nils Andresen. He'll be going over municipal taxes. And then we will hear House Bill 109, Reduction to Corporate Income Tax Rate. The first item on the agenda will be to hear from Nils, Mr. Andresen, and Alaska Municipal League. Sir, if you could come forward, and we will get the slides up, and you can introduce yourself. But before we do that, we'll take a brief at ease and make sure that all the technology is going. Okay, we're back on the record. Mr. Andresen, can you please put yourself on the record by giving us your name and begin your presentation?
Yeah, thank you. For the record, Nils Andresen, and I'm the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League, and appreciate being invited today to House Ways and Means to talk a little bit about municipal taxation. I should note to start with that I'm not an expert at municipal taxation, and the state does have good resources within Division of Community Regional Affairs, for instance, and the State Assessor's Office, so I can direct all follow-up questions to him if you want. But we do have a state that has a lot of expertise at the local level in taxation, and I'll touch on, from our perspective, kind of the main points as it affects local governments.
We've got about 45 minutes to an hour to go through your slides and have a conversation. Do you want to do questions as you go or at the end? How would you prefer?
Sure. Chair, along the way is just fine.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well,
so tax authority for local governments comes directly from the Alaska Constitution, and it's built on in Title 29, mainly of the Alaska statutes. And I won't go through this slide or some of what else comes from the Constitution or statute, but I did want to leave you with this as a resource. That delegation of state taxation power to is only delegated to organized cities and boroughs. I think that's important because prior to statehood, school districts as well had that authority, and that was changed. Within the Constitution, it's different than potentially other states. It is true that taxes need to be for a public purpose. Local governments have very broad authority, broad powers delegated to them by the Constitution. This last point, that it's a liberal construction shall be given to the powers of local government, is important. It really means that local governments have very broad authority over real and personal property, unless it's specifically exempted in law. And the Constitution's clear, too, that while that power of taxation is subdivided, delegated to organized cities and boroughs, it is through law that there are standards prescribed.
Please let the record reflect that 604, Representative Allard joined us. Thank you. Please continue.
Within law, then, there are a number of limitations on taxation, and that it differs a little bit by the type of municipality or the classification of municipality. So home rule governments, as you know, have all the legislative powers available to them that aren't prohibited by law or charter. So anything that's not prohibited by statute or within their own governing documents, they have the ability to do. That's different than general law, cities and boroughs, which are constrained by and directed by statute. So they have all the powers given to them by state law. The when it comes to property tax, all of that is found in Title 29. With our borough city structure, it's important to know that taxes within a city or by a city are collected by the borough on their behalf.
Please let the record reflect that at 6:06 p.m. we were joined by Representative Prox. Thank you, sir, for being here. Please continue.
The additional limitations on taxation are included, again, in Title 29. They can be applicable to taxes for operating expenses and not to taxes collected to pay for bonded indebtedness. Bond debt is specifically called out as something where property tax can be assessed to cover that obligation. One of the things that I've come across in my 5 years in this position is a belief that second-class cities don't have the ability to levy property taxes, and that's not actually accurate, that they can levy property taxes, similar to first-class cities, they can do that with the vote of the people, similar to other types of taxation. For second-class cities, they are limited in their property tax in that they can't exceed 20 mils, when for everyone else or every other type of city or borough, it's 30 mils, though nobody goes beyond 20. I mentioned the state assessor previously, located within Division or Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. And the state assessor is the one who, consistent with the Constitution and state law, it oversees the activities of local assessors and is the resource at the state level for monitoring the levy of property taxes and how they're applied. And those previous three slides, I drew those directly from Alaska Taxable, which is a publication of the state assessor. So there's definitely a deeper dive that you could do within that document, and those specifications related to Constitution and law are found there. Now, when it comes to property tax, I see often comments about who pays the most property tax. I pulled this map, I think, from the Tax Foundation. And it's easy to think that we're like the rest of the nation. And I think there's a couple things to draw from this map. One, that there are areas of Alaska that have no property tax applied to them within the unorganized borough. Even within organized boroughs, there are exceptions to the rule. And that's fairly unlike most other states in the nation. The other thing that I would note about the map is that while it looks potentially like a large area of the state is covered by property tax, it could be that within that census area, there's a single jurisdiction, a single municipality that actually has the property tax, and the rest of the census area doesn't have a property tax. So it might be very singular in how it's applied. There are 24 of 165 taxing jurisdictions in Alaska with a property tax. That doesn't necessarily mean that it could be that a city within a borough has a property tax. So you get kind of layers of property tax within a single jurisdiction. But it wouldn't be the same as saying that that property tax extends to 24 singular jurisdictions on their own. So there's overlap between them. That's 15% of communities. It's worth knowing that property tax doesn't apply to 60,000 residents. It doesn't apply to the majority of communities in Alaska. It does apply to the majority of residents in Alaska.
Just out of curiosity, do you know if there is a trend nationwide as to whether jurisdictions are moving towards or away from property taxes?
Chair Carpenter, I'm not sure. There is, I mean, we do monitor some of the research reports that come out of things like Tax Foundation or the Institute of Taxation and Economic Policy, other types of research organizations. But I don't know that there's a clear trend away or toward. I think, and we'll talk more about exemptions, but probably that's where more of the research is focused on kind of the impact of exemptions and how it distorts the base that the property tax is applied to.
Thank you. Please continue.
There are limits on property taxes. And again, the Constitution, with its liberal construction of powers to local governments, makes available all real and personal property to be taxable unless it's specifically exempted. And those exemptions are found in AS 2945-030. There are only a few examples here of exemptions in statute. I mentioned earlier that no municipality may levy taxes exceeding 3% or 30 mils. And I'm not going to explain mils, or I shouldn't attempt at least, but it's worth knowing that, again, that there aren't any local governments that go above 20, and probably for specific reasons. That tax limitation has been interpreted by the Alaska Supreme Court to apply only to property. There's types of property that's exempt. Property owned by INCSA corporations is exempt from municipal property tax unless it's leased or developed. And that the same is true for federal, for state property, especially where there's state property that would normally be exempt. If it's leased or developed, that becomes available for taxation. And then all taxable real and personal property within a municipality is included in its full value determination. And the FVD is part of how the calculation of the required local contribution is made for aides to schools.
I think we have a question here. Representative McCabe, do you have a question?
I'm good.
Okay. I was wrong. Please continue.
I figured that you're lucky.
Well, I'm sure they're coming.
So I mentioned INCSA corporations and state land. When it comes to property tax, and when it comes probably to all taxes, it's all about the base. And for Alaska, we know just how extensive public lands are. But it's worth kind of coming back to this and really thinking about it in terms of property tax. 99% of the lands in Alaska aren't taxed or don't have property tax applied to them. And this is a point that the state assessor makes in saying that Alaska is the only state in the U.S. where a large part of the land mass of the state is not subject to a property tax. It's 1%, and then you can compare that to 42 states that have greater than 50% of their land as taxable or not public land. I think there are more than 10 states with greater than 80% of the lands are available for taxation. So of a total land base of 365.5 million, the majority of that is federal. We know state lands, just under 100 million, INCSA lands of 44 million acres, and just a very, very small amount of that is taxable. So automatically, when we're thinking about property tax, it's only being applied to a very limited amount of land in the state. And that has implications on rate and value, for that matter. We talked earlier about the limit on property tax rates, and that it can't go above 30 mils. So the state assessor applies a formula for determining effective mill rates, and mill rates in Alaska range from 5.62, which is in Skagway, to 20 in Valdez. Again, all local governments that apply a property tax leave that room between 20 and 30 available for future taxation. If you take those local governments with the property tax and average them out, it's about 11.12 mils that's being applied to property in Alaska. Of the 11.12, if we took that as a standard number, then you know one way to think about the state's required local contribution, the mandatory taxation, property tax that's applied to those with municipal school districts, is that 2.65 mils of that 11.12 is the state's property tax, and it's meant for public education, which leaves you with 8.47 effective mill rate that's available for local decision making. You can apply that to a total assessed value of $108 billion. That $108 billion number is straight from Alaska taxable. You then have to back out the mandatory state exemption, exemptions of $7.2 billion, or roughly 6.49% of your tax base reduced or exempted. And then you have to back out the optional local exemptions of $18 billion. Dollars in value, or another 18.3%. So when it comes to the base, we take a base of 1% of all lands in Alaska, valued at $108 billion. We reduce that by $25 billion and apply an effective rate of 8.47 mils for local decision making.
Representative Grobe. Do you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Chair Krupner. Could you explain for the committee the 2.65 mils for the state property tax for public education, how that's calculated and how that flows? Is that a rate in the state statutes that says every municipality that taxes property has to tax 2.65 for state property tax for public education? Like I said, could you explain?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Groh. 2.65 mils is in statute, required by local governments with municipal school districts to apply as part of their property tax or an equivalent. And so I think there are just under a handful of municipalities who use fish tax, for instance, or something else to in place of their property tax. But it's the state's required tax collection for those local governments with a municipal school district. And then that's applied to the full value determination. The full value determination is the total assessed value less the mandatory state exemptions. And that's what determines, I think it might go through more of a formula than that, but that's what gets you to the required local contribution. And then there's a cap, of course, beyond that.
Thank you.
Please continue.
In speaking of the mandatory exemptions, one of the most significant is the senior citizen and disabled veteran property tax exemption. And this is an exemption whose value right now is $103 million. That's $103 million less that local governments are collecting through their property tax. It's not applied to the full value determination, so it doesn't impact, it does impact school funding to some degree, but it's not coming out of the tax base otherwise. The value of that exemption has doubled in the last 10 years. Just in 2012, it was $56 million. It's required in state statute to be reimbursed. That hasn't been done since fiscal year 97, almost 20 years of not having that reimbursed. The effect of that, I mean, in terms of the base, for what is already a limited base, we're removing and shifting that property tax to other taxpayers effectively with a mandatory exemption. And while it's easy to think that the $103 million gets split out to all communities evenly, again, it's only those 24 that have a property tax. And then even for those 24, the value is different. The total amount that's exempted is different. And the percentage as a portion of their overall tax collection or value is different. And so you can see in the chart on the right that, for instance, the city and borough of Wrangell, that property, that mandatory exemption is more than 18% of their assessed value. For Whittier and Unalaska, it's less than 2%, and it varies in scale. It's also that exemption that the value of the $103 million is felt differently by each of those 24 local governments, since all local government budgets aren't created equal. AML does have a position to reimburse local governments for that mandatory exemption according to statute. And then at a national level, I'll just note that AARP has said that when it comes to property tax relief, like a mandatory exemption, that should be targeted to homeowners with low and moderate incomes. So it's kind of a means testing or circuit breaker effect that they've advocated for.
That's an interesting graph. If that's a true distribution of where senior citizens live within the state, it's the first time that I've seen that kind of compared to areas of the state.
Right.
Thank you. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm just trying to wrap my head around, you know, that it's required by law to be reimbursed by the state. And I guess in other words, when people get exempted from paying the property tax, the state should reimburse the municipality for the amount of property tax that they lost because this person was exempted?
Representative Gray, through the chair, that's right. And I guess the state is, by the legislature, is the more appropriate term as the appropriating body. But it hasn't been appropriated since 1997. And the functionality of it would be that, yes, annually, as that exemption is applied by the local government and the estate assessor would agree on what the value of that exemption was, and that would be reimbursed according to the state budget.
Follow up. And the exemptions are, like they said, senior citizens, veterans, like anything that people get exemptions from their property tax?
Yeah, Representative Gray, through the chair, it's only those specifically called out in 29.45.030. I think that was right. It's fairly limited for the mandatory one. So it's senior citizens, it's disabled veterans, maybe it's farmland is the third that I can think of. But the first two are kind of combined into one in most terminology. It's worth noting that local governments can add additional optional exemptions beyond that. Those aren't removed from the full value determination. So if they exempt something else, then that they still aren't paying the 2.65 mils, for instance, on it.
Representative Allard.
Thank you. So through the chair, when the municipality, I'll give an example, Anchorage. When they're doing exemptions for veterans and senior citizens, I don't know if there's another one, but that would be a reallocation of funds, and somewhere in there, a taxpayer will be paying and picking up what the discount or exemption is.
Representative Allard, through the chair, that's right. And that state-required exemption then spreads out. I mean, if you've got a budget at one level and you're not able to access the full tax to meet that budget, then the tax rate goes up and it's spread out to other taxpayers.
Follow up.
Thank you. And based on this slide, would the reallocation only be for the muni-wide, or could it be a family in Cordova sharing that tax burden with the exemption from the municipality of Anchorage? Or would it only come from our taxpayers from the municipality?
Right, through the chair, Representative Allard, just within it, it's kept within that municipality.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. So maybe jumping up a little bit higher in the overall look at this. You know, you kind of mentioned that it was shared. It's really only shared the burden amongst 24 that are taxed, right? So are these 24 entities represent the total 1%, I mean, of privately owned or of available land in the state? Or is there some, or is this a smaller subset of that 1%?
Right. Representative McCabe, through the chair. So for the 24, those are the local governments that have the property tax, and their property tax applies to that 1% of available taxable land within their jurisdiction. It might be that within each jurisdiction, more of their area is available for taxation compared to the 1% at the state level. For each of those jurisdictions, the exemption is singularly applied within their jurisdiction. So for all commercial and residential properties or taxable projects within a city or borough, that's where the exemption is being spread out. So it wouldn't affect, but it's 600,000 Alaska residents that are within those 24 jurisdictions.
Follow up, Representative McCabe.
600,000 or 60,000? I thought I saw.
Representative McCabe, it's 600. Yeah, it's 60,000 who it doesn't apply to. So 700. Yeah.
So one more follow up. So and I might as well maybe stop dancing around this, but none of this applies to the unorganized borough. Almost zero of this. In fact, zero of this applies to the unorganized borough. Not that they have a huge tax base anyways, but.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, almost. So within the unorganized borough, you do have home rule cities and first-class cities. So, for instance, City of Unalaska would be within the unorganized borough, but it would apply to them. There are a number of others, City of Nenana, City of St. Mary's, etc.
Okay, thank you.
Please continue.
So what property, I mean, for those of you familiar with local government, I mean, you've probably seen numbers like this before, but when we're thinking about property exemptions, it was interesting to me to look at what does this look like at the local level. And so this is an example of a jurisdiction with a property tax and the long list of potential exemptions that they are looking at each year, whether they're mandatory or optional, which year they apply to, and then they compare that year to year to see how the amount is going up or down, the number of exemptions applied, and what that value looks like. So if they start out with valuation applied to commercial, residential, and vacant land, $5.8 billion, reduce that out by $500 million in value, they're left with total real property value of $5.3 billion. So that's the effect of and the number of exemptions that are applied. As many of you have already noted, those exemptions, whether mandatory or optional, do shift the tax burden to other taxpayers. You've reduced your base, and you have to make that up somewhere when you've got a budget that says one thing. It's important to understand that in the context of the budget. Property taxes are different than sales taxes or other types of taxes that they're determined post-budget. So rather than looking at what did we collect one year, what are we going to collect based on the rate that we've already set, the mill rate is determined post-budget, and it's adjusted to pay for the priorities and obligations that are set out in budget. It makes sense that a lower rate can be applied when there's higher value or a higher base, and then a higher rate applied when there's a lower value or a lower base. The tax bill might vary, if you are assessed at a higher value, then it might take a lower tax rate to get to the budget that's been established by the jurisdiction. If you're assessed at a lower rate, it will take a higher tax rate to get to that same budget number. So that equation gets determined every year. I think it's important to know that there's no difference in Alaska between residential, industrial, and commercial types of property, though it is more common elsewhere in the nation to have those taxed differently at different rates. And again, the state can offset any of a property tax rate through the reimbursement of the mandatory exemptions, or in kind of current research, something like a circuit breaker program, which is a program determined by the state or federal government to offset the costs that might be being experienced at the local level by low income or other types of vulnerable populations within a community.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, in other states, what's more typical? Is it typical to tax higher on industrial commercial or lower? Or what's the typical difference in property tax between residential, industrial, and commercial?
Representative Gray, through the chair, I haven't looked at that actually, and we could follow up and get you those numbers. I will say it probably depends on what you're trying to achieve. And that's the reason, and that's how you approach tax policy generally. If you're trying to offset the cost experienced by families, then you would have a lower rate for families or residential. If you're trying to spur economic development or commercial development, then you would look for different types of rates. But you can really, it's a lever that you can move around pretty in sophisticated ways to kind of get at the target that you're trying to achieve. But I'll get you those numbers.
Please continue.
Again, this is from Alaska Taxable, so I won't spend too much time on it. But if we're shifting from property tax to sales tax, that's the other main tax experienced at the local level. It's in statute that there's the authorization to levy sales and use taxes, building on the liberal construction given to local governments in the Constitution. There are very few, I mean, as opposed to property tax, where there's a long list of potential exemptions allowed, there are very few limitations placed upon municipalities in regards to levying a sales tax. Orbital space facilities, alcohol has to be taxed at the same amount. You can't levy a sales tax on a construction contract. And then there are other exemptions that may be granted by local ordinance. There are probably not on this list, but generally speaking, there are other very common exemptions determined at the federal and state level as it applies to sales tax. So sales tax doesn't apply to nonprofits. It doesn't apply to federal and state agencies and others. I think that's there aren't any, as opposed to property tax, where the 30 mils is set out in statute as the limitation on taxation. There aren't limits on sales taxes. The only reference in statute to a limitation is that if interest is charged on unpaid sales taxes, the interest may not exceed 15%. But otherwise, there's no limit. So when you look at the data for local governments, like I mentioned, this is the more prevalent of taxes, property versus sales. And by prevalence, I mean number of communities who depend on this as their source of revenue. Usually when I'm talking, I say it's 106 local governments that have a sales tax. When I looked at Alaska Taxable, it was only 100. But it really depends on which year you're looking at and whether they reported on what their rate in collection was. So it's somewhere just over 100 municipalities that do collect a sales tax. A sales tax does not apply to 600,000 residents. And I think Representative McCabe, I misspoke earlier. It was, you were right, that it was 60,000 that a property tax does not apply to. When it comes to sales tax, 600,000 that a sales tax doesn't apply to. The average rate I tried to keep this to those jurisdictions where there was data, clear data for what their rate was at that time. The average rate between those 100 municipalities is 3.8%, with the highest being 7%. And there are a number of communities, and I kind of split the difference in figuring out average rate, but there are six with seasonal rates that have a lower rate in a higher rate when there are more visitors and a lower rate when there are just residents in their communities. So really focused on travel and tourism and non-resident dollars. Alaska taxable does list an implied tax base of $7.6 billion, which isn't, I can't imagine that's correct, mostly because it applies a pretty straight formula between rate and collected to equal implied tax base, and it doesn't account for all the exemptions. And so you could actually think about if you didn't have as many types of exemptions applied at the local level, then it would be a different number with an effective tax base. So potentially that tax base is much larger with fewer exemptions applied.
The implied tax base of $7.6 billion is referencing those jurisdictions that have a sales tax, or the entire state, 600,000 residents that aren't,
right,
don't have a sales tax.
Representative Carpenter, it's based on those with the sales tax, if I remember that chart. Yeah, sorry. So when we're thinking further about sales tax, so while the average rate of 3.8% makes some sense, it's worth knowing that, you know, there are 20% who have a rate above 5%. There's about 20% who have a rate lower than 3%, but that middle ground between 3 and 5% is where most communities land. When it comes to sales tax collection, there's only a very few jurisdictions that collect more than $10 million. There's a similarly small number of communities that are collecting under 100,000. And then it's split in segments between kind of a $1 to $10 million collected and 100,000 to a million. And these numbers really speak to the diversity of communities, that not all communities are created equal. You know, for those that are collecting less than 100,000, that might be the entirety of their annual budget. So it could be, you know, between 50 and 80% of their revenue each year. And then sales tax per capita, if you split out the per capita numbers and or the tax numbers from sales tax and property and just focus on sales tax, there's a small portion where in those communities residents are paying above $2,000 a year, but the majority paying under $1,000.
But again, that number reflects only those jurisdictions that are actually paying the sales tax per 700 and some thousand residents, or is it just residents of those jurisdictions?
That is, Chair, it's for those jurisdictions, just focused on those jurisdictions. So for where there's not a sales tax, it's not applicable. I mentioned overall revenue before, but first, I mean, I think one of the interesting things to look at when it comes to sales tax is how stable it's actually been. Where I mentioned with property tax, you adjust it each year up and down based on your budget, and because your tax base is hopefully growing over the years, that stays relatively stable. Sales tax actually has stayed fairly stable over those, at least the last 20 years, and maybe more so in terms of kind of just what rate is residents should be expecting. So of the 100, more than half haven't changed their sales tax at all in 20 years. 20 have only increased it by 1%, and 16 with increases between 1.5% and 4%. I think one of the reasons that we've seen increases over the last 20 years, a large portion of those increases are based on kind of in the early 2000s, when the state faced a fiscal challenge, it eliminated community revenue sharing, otherwise known today as community assistance. When community assistance went away, 15 communities closed their doors, 28 increased their sales tax. So there's a pretty bright line around that period of time and what happens when community assistance goes away. So that's how we attribute, that's to what we attribute some of that increase. And then I mentioned how important a sales tax revenue is to communities. There are 14 that have this as more than 50% of their budget. And so if you see, if there's anything done at any level where sales tax revenues are diminished, it has a real direct impact on those local governments who have greater dependence on that tax.
Representative Groh.
Thank you, Chair. Sir, at various times over the past decades, the state legislature has considered proposals for a statewide sales tax of general application. Has the Alaska Municipal League ever expressed concerns about what effects the state adopting a statewide sales tax of general application would have on municipal governments that levy sales taxes?
Yes.
Follow up?
Through the chair. And I will actually speak to it a little bit later.
Okay, thank you.
Sometimes simple answers are best when it comes to those kinds of questions.
Always.
We'll talk more about it.
Please continue.
One of the things I was asked to talk about is the impact of remote sales tax collection or online sales tax. So the next few slides are focused on that, and then I'll come back to a broader sales tax discussion. Wayfair is the Supreme Court case that you most often will hear about when it comes to online sales tax. So it's Wayfair versus South Dakota. Is that right? I think so. What Wayfair did, for many years prior, there was a court case called Quill that said you had to have physical presence in a jurisdiction to have sales tax apply. And what Wayfair did is eliminated the requirement for physical presence. And instead, based on really the scale and scope of online sales and in the interest of leveling the playing field, the Supreme Court focused on establishing an economic nexus instead. So you had to establish an economic nexus within a state to have a remote sales tax or have your sales tax apply to remote sales. There were three additional kind of guidelines that the Supreme Court outlined in the Wayfair case. They required a state to implement, if it were to implement sales tax collection on remote sales, that it had to have a system that was streamlined statewide and single level. And what the Supreme Court is interested in is ensuring that states are consistent with the Interstate Commerce Clause and making sure that any single state isn't burdening the sale and the conduct of commerce between states. So that's applied to all the states that have a sales tax of 45 of 50, I think. That happened, I think, just in 2018, which was the year I started at AML. So this gave me a good project to work on to kick things off. Alaska is unique in the nation in that while it doesn't have a sales tax, it does allow, and the Constitution provides for local governments to have a sales tax separately. And so AML worked with local governments to establish the Alaska Remote Seller Sales Tax Commission. That commission focused then on developing a streamlined statewide single level process that would comply with Wayfair, and we believe it does. There's a uniform code that all jurisdictions that participate in the Alaska Remote Seller Sales Tax Commission have applied to them. They've all adopted. They've entered into an intergovernmental agreement and then adopted the uniform code. It doesn't change their rates and exemptions, so it maintains local control. What it does is streamline definitions, and then the commission also manages an online portal for single registration and filing, which is the single-level administration component of the Wayfair test. There are 45 of 100 communities that are participating in the ARSSTC. And that's where remote sales tax would apply. For those outside the 45, it would only be through voluntary compliance that remote sales tax would be collected. And then AML administers the collection of those taxes. The experience then of collection over these last few years, so 46 participating communities grown over the four-year period. I think there were 14 communities, seven communities that originally signed the intergovernmental agreement establishing the Remote Sales Tax Commission. So that's grown over these four years. We now have almost 3,000 registered sellers. So all sellers who have an economic nexus in the state or who are choosing to comply because it's easier and better through the commission have registered through the portal that we've developed. You can see here the monthly totals and how growth has occurred over the last 3 years. I would say that, you know, as fewer communities sign up, as fewer sellers register, this will kind of flatten out a little bit, but it has grown pretty well over these last few years. And it's easy to think that's the solution for local governments. They've got online sales tax and they're covered. It's still a very small portion of their total sales tax collected. So of 200, I mean, we're talking about $20 million of $240 million collected in sales tax of total revenue, tax revenue of $2.5 billion. And it's only applicable to those 46 communities. So it has been beneficial to those participating communities. It's not impacting those who don't have a sales tax and those who aren't participating. And at the community level, it does make a difference. And that varies between 5 and 20% of physical sales tax collection. So where a greater portion of your purchases in a community are online, it represents a greater portion of local revenues than in communities where you've got more purchase options.
Listen to you.
One of the things that has fascinated me, again, if it's all about the base, and the base in this case is all the sales that are occurring online, we do have pretty good data about how local governments through exemptions reduce that base. And so in 2021, on $556 million in gross sales, $207 million of that was exempt, 37%. In 2022, on $865 million in gross sales, $306 million was exempt, or 41%. So we're exempting about 40% of what would otherwise have tax available. And some of those exemption categories are very straightforward. Resale is the largest exemption. So if you were contemplating a sales tax, for instance, I mean, knowing that that resale is a large exemption is important. Government is a big part of it. Nonprofits are a smaller portion of it. Many local governments have a cap after which sales tax doesn't apply, and that that threshold further reduces the sales tax collected. And then everything else is under other, and the fact that it's number two in exemptions, I think kind of speaks to me that there's a lot of other things that we add on within communities to fine tune the tax that we've got.
To what do you attribute the percentage change between 2021 and 2022?
Chair Carpenter, I think that's mostly that it's a growing program. So as new sellers come on, as new communities come on, it adjusts. The exemption rate by community, so if between those 2 years, five communities came on with exemption rates less than 25%, they would dramatically change the makeup of the overall exemption. And similarly, if you had a community come in that was over 50%, it would increase the exemption. So I think right now we're still discovering a lot of how online sales occur and how exemptions are applied. But the scale of variability between communities, I think, is really impressive. And there are some communities where that exemption rate is just under 10%, and there are some communities where that exemption rate is more than 80%. That they've taken off of what's available for taxation.
Local control.
That is local control.
Please continue.
And then to speak to, I guess Representative Groh asked earlier about statewide sales tax. AML has, I think, in the past opposed a statewide sales tax. And this slide tries to capture why. Many previous bills that I've seen come and proposed by the legislature have started by taking away the ability of local governments to tax it, to implement a tax rate and exemptions and collection on their own. And that removal of local control has been extremely problematic. I think that what's changed in recent years, AML does have a resolution in support of a broad-based tax with a preference for an income tax, but consideration of a sales tax as long as it doesn't do some of those things. So as long as it protects local collection of sales tax, as long as it allows for rates and exemptions at the local level and kind of respects the current integrity of local taxation and governance, then there are maybe ways to consider a state sales tax. There are our experience, or I would say our experience with the remote sales tax collection. We know that technology allows for different rates, exemptions, variability within a system, even as there's a common rule of the road when it comes to collection in a jurisdiction or between jurisdictions. Ultimately, but I think when we think about a sales tax, you'll start thinking about local tax burden. And so if there are rates out there of 7%, additional rates would crowd out potentially the collection that's currently occurring. So you want to think about how an additional rate would be how complicate things at the local level if we were to talk about sales tax. There are other taxes out there, and I'll skim through these, but excise taxes, that's the performance of an act. Some of these are services, but it includes severance taxes, only a few of those occurring in the state. There's no distinction here between home rule and general law, local governments, nor is it subject to voter ratification. So this excise taxes are allowed under that liberal construction of local government powers in the Constitution. Bed and rental car taxes are examples of excise taxes. These can come as an ad valorem, a percentage, or a flat rate. There are 49 communities with a bed tax. They have an effective rate of between 4 and 12%, collecting just $31 million each year. And then there's just two communities that were identified in Alaska taxables having a rental car tax with the rate of 8% or $7.31 million collected. I think, the point of these excise taxes to really shift the local tax burden to non-residents. So where you have visitors or workforce participating in activity in a community, bed and rental car taxes are trying to capture that extra amount of folks coming into town. I think there are future considerations, and I would point to short-term rentals as being in terms of a national trend, something that jurisdictions around the nation are looking at, how to effectively manage those, ensure compliance with local code and law, and then tax them appropriately. Marketplace facilitators are another, it's a little bit sales tax, a little bit excise tax, but a marketplace facilitator is an online platform that facilitates the sale or service of sale of goods or services. So it would be your Airbnbs or other types of activities where there's a physical presence in a community. Somebody has a car, somebody has a house, but it's that online platform where the business is conducted. Peer-to-peer sharing is kind of similar. There's apps for that. So those are other maybe future things that local governments might look at.
Representative McCabe, you have a question?
Thanks, through the chair, Mr. Andresen. So I don't, on your bed taxes, I see 49 communities. I think I read somewhere that Alaska is the only state that has no bed tax statewide. I mean, I've spent 17 days a month for the last 20 years in hotel rooms. In every hotel room I have, it's usually a local tax, a state tax, sometimes a value-added tax in foreign countries. I just read that recently that Alaska does not have a statewide bed tax. Is that?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I think it's accurate that Alaska does not have a statewide bed tax. Whether it's the only one in the nation that doesn't have one, I'm not sure, but I could follow up with the committee on that.
Representative McCabe.
What would you call, and through the chair, what would you call a Medicaid tax?
I don't know.
Service tax, excise tax?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. In terms of, so this would be fun to do then with bed taxes. And there are consumption taxes, otherwise known as sin taxes, alcohol, tobacco, marijuana, to sin or not to sin, I'm not sure. But I am interested in the revenue from whatever activity is chosen. I think it's interesting that there was an article that asked which states have the highest sin taxes. Alaska came up number one. And it's another article more recently that shows marijuana outpacing alcohol in other places in the nation. This is just for local governments in terms of which communities are participating and the amount collecting. And I think you've already heard from the state about other state level taxes that apply to especially wholesale alcohol, tobacco, and marijuana. But this is how it breaks down for local governments.
Representative Gray, for a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, can you talk or do you know anything about video game taxing and how that works? I just noticed that was the maroon color and that was in four or five states.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, I don't know enough about it. I think the other one that's out there is like sports. Well, I guess that maybe comes under casino, but I mean, there are definitely taxes that we don't have here in Alaska, partly because we don't have state level allowance for those taxes. So where there's not a state level permission to do gaming type taxes, couldn't occur.
Do you know what the second word is after video gaming? Is that a typo or is that an actual word? That...
Betting.
Is that how you spell mutual? I don't think so.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's, I don't know. It didn't come from me.
Okay. It's fine. Yeah. We can do some more research on video gaming.
Video gaming.
Do you have a question? Representative McCabe has a question on this slide.
Through the chair, Mr. Andresen. So, I mean, that's been a big discussion in ALEC, Route 50, CSG in the last 2 weeks is the amount of money, say, that New York has made in the last year. They instituted sports betting a year ago, almost exactly a year ago. I get that New York's huge compared to us, but and I think they have a 51% tax. Maybe on the winnings, or I'm not sure, but $700 million they took in 1 year on sports betting. So I guess I'm curious if that is what the video game parimutuel betting, maybe that's what that's about. I don't know. I guess we can find out. But,
as he didn't create the slides, I'm sure he can't really elaborate on this particular, but I think it is worth asking the question.
All I can say, Chair Carpenter and Representative McCabe, is we don't do that here. And local governments don't currently tax in that way.
Follow up.
I did hear a radio ad in Anchorage 2 days ago for DraftKings. We don't do sports betting, then why are we hearing ads in Alaska for it? Or maybe we do, and we just don't know about it.
It would have fallen on deaf ears. I wouldn't have known what they were talking about. All right. Worth the question. Thank you. Please continue.
Yeah. We're getting toward the end, I think. There are additional taxes that local governments implement, resource taxes, the raw fish tax is one of those. There's other tax revenue that apply to some communities. I think, I mean, and I've called out, you know, 16 communities here, 18 communities there, 49 communities. Taxes aren't created equal. Communities aren't created equal. That real variation between communities means that their taxes are specific to the community. And I think that's worth keeping in mind. This chart is old, but I did want to kind of highlight that, you know, back in 2013 when there was $85 million going out in community assistance, and in 2014 in $60 million, you know, taxes aren't really making up the difference for that that decrease. So, you know, that was negotiated in response to the state's fiscal condition, but taxes, or at least these taxes, aren't really making up a difference when it comes to the level of state support that local governments previously experienced.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, is it possible to get, this was last six years ago, is it possible to get updated information? Can we get that for the committee members?
Yeah, through the chair, I can update these slides or this chart.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
So if it's all about the base, then there's one other tax that I would mention. State statute does preempt municipal collection of net income tax, but I like to argue that it's silent on gross or payroll tax. That's not something that local governments are talking about, and it would be difficult to administer at the local level. But in terms of municipal taxation, it is one that's out there as a potential. And then I would just note that at the state level, one of the reasons to think about a broad-based tax is because it's all about the base. An income tax has the largest available base. It's not diminished by federal and state lands. It's not diminished by exemptions, a long list of exemptions that might be applicable at the to sales tax. It doesn't differentiate between residents and non-residents. It really is a base that when we're thinking about at the tax level applies most broadly. Leave it at that. Just to wrap up, so the taxes that are out there for local governments, developed by local governments in response to powers that they have from the Constitution and in statute, developed over the last 50 plus years to meet the needs of their communities. But it's really important when we're thinking about tax to think not just macro level, but to think at the community level. So as you're thinking, as any of us are thinking about what's good for the state, we also have to think about at the community level what's important. And there's a pretty, I think, significant feedback loop between, you know, families and jobs and education and services and infrastructure that if a local government's not able to support or deliver or incentivize at any one of those different touch points and have all of those be well connected, then it's really hard to see communities develop in the way that we want. And we won't see Alaska succeed if we end up with disincentives at the local level. That's been our history. Local governments will shift to meet emerging needs. We know that there are current challenges that communities are experiencing, and whether that's housing or workforce, childcare, et cetera, Local governments will evaluate their current tax burden to meet those priorities. They'll reevaluate their legacy levels of taxation, rates and exemptions to move incentives around that might be not less necessary at this point. Ultimately, they're going to focus on community stability and economic growth because those are their responsibilities. Thank you.
No more questions from the committee, it looks like. Representative McCabe.
Thank you, through the chair. So very early on, maybe on slide 9 or somewhere around there, you mentioned that these exemptions were sort of shifting the burden of the taxpaying into a certain different subset or away from, say, seniors and military. But isn't that the same with an income tax, where especially a progressive income tax, where we are shifting the burden of paying for this into maybe the higher income earners, as opposed to, say, a flat tax where everybody pays $5 a year, 5% or something like that? Isn't that virtually the same thing? Or you could even say taking away the PFDs. Some people say that's a tax, and we're shifting, you know, we're putting the burden on people taking away their PFD to pay for some government services that not everybody shares. So any form of taxation, in my opinion, when, and you might agree with this or you might not, is sort of shifting the burden around to pay for what we deem as a society is most necessary. There was a question in there somewhere, I'm sure.
There was a question in there. Representative McCabe, through the chair. I think there's a lot of lenses to look at taxation through. I tried to focus today on base. And I think it's one way to think about a tax. The distributional impacts of taxation is another lens. The value to the state versus the value to a community is another lens. They end up being a little bit circular arguments too, because you can, if you're focused on one lens and I'm focused on the other, then it ends up really challenging to think through what's best for a community or a state. But I think when it comes to base, it's one tool that you have to evaluate what's right. And we'll save the rest for an income tax discussion. I'll come better prepared.
Correct answer. Thank you.
Yeah. I would just like to point out that at this opportunity to say that the lens that I'm looking through as we are discussing fiscal long-term fiscal policy is what helps grow our economy. And I think at the local level, that's important. At the state level, it's certainly important. And I'm not just looking at it from the perspective of revenue for those jurisdictions. I'm looking at it from a perspective, are we going to have more jobs next year than we did this year? And what regime do we put in place that enables or empowers that growth that we want to see? So that is also a lens to look at the question of taxation through. Okay. Well, if there are no more questions, Mr. Andreessen, thank you for coming and sharing with us today. And I think we'll transition to our next presentation here. Thank you.
Thanks, Nils.
Thank you.
Okay, let's see. Next on the agenda is to hear House Bill 109. And I am the sponsor of House Bill 109, so we're going to do a quick swap here, and I'm going to hand the gavel over to Representative McCabe, and then I will come down to the hot seat and present the bill with my staff. So I will officially hand the gavel over to Representative McCabe.
All right. So we're joined by Representative Carpenter and his aide. Would you please put your names on the record and begin your presentation on HB 109, Reduced Corporate Net Income Tax Rate.
Thank you, Chair McCabe, and fellow House Ways and Means members. My name is Representative Ben Carpenter. I am the representative for 8 Northern Kenai Peninsula, and I'm joined here with my trusty staff.
Kendra Broussard, staff to Representative Carpenter.
And I think if it's okay with the chair, I'll just proceed with the sponsor statement,
please,
as you will. Okay, well, to take it off the top, Alaska's economy is lagging that of the nation and has been for a while. Our GDP, which is our economic growth over the last decade, has been worst in the country. 68,000 more people left Alaska than have moved here from other states over the last decade. In our modern economy, people are mobile and will move for employment opportunities. The House Ways and Means Committee has been tasked with improving Alaska's economy. That's why this bill came forward. Reducing the cost of doing business in Alaska is a good place to start. Our corporate income tax, corporate income taxes are levied in 44 states, and 29 states have single rate corporate tax systems. While often thought of as a major tax type, states' corporate income taxes account for an average of just over 7% of state tax collections and 4% of state general revenue in fiscal year 2021. While these figures are not high, they are among the reasons corporations decide where to conduct business. Alaska's 9.4% corporate income tax rate currently has the fourth highest tax rate and the highest graduation of rates in the nation. Only New Jersey, Minnesota, and Illinois have higher rates. House Bill 109 would reduce Alaska's rates to a single rate and the lowest rate in the nation for states with corporate taxes. North Carolina currently has the lowest corporate income tax rate at 2.5% currently, but will phase this out by 2030. Graduated corporate rates are inequitable. That is, the size of a corporation bears no necessary relation to the income levels of the owners. Low-income corporations may be owned by individuals with high incomes, and high-income corporations may be owned by individuals with low incomes. A single-rate system minimizes the incentive for firms to engage in economically wasteful tax planning to mitigate the damage of higher marginal rates that some states levy as taxable income increases or rises. A low, flat-rate corporate tax will significantly level the playing field between C-corps, S-corps, and LLCs, or limited liability corporations. Low corporate tax rates have been proven to increase productivity, which leads to improved economic output for the state. Corporate income taxes are also volatile, as they are taxes on production. As we've seen in previous presentations in this committee, they're one of the highest or the highest volatile taxes in our state. When corporate income tax rates get high enough, the business will produce less in that state. This is because the business, as opposed to the customers, are the less elastic side of the market. Customers, which is the more elastic side of the market, may decide no longer to buy from businesses with the higher price. Elasticity also increases the more time passes after a price change. As time goes on, the corporate income tax will mean that a business hires fewer workers and or moves the business out of the state because the income tax has made the cost of doing business in that state prohibitively high. As businesses leave the state, income tax revenue decreases in the years that follow. This makes revenue volatility for income taxes relatively high compared to that of sales or use taxes. Economically competitive states like North Carolina have been reducing rates, flattening their brackets, or phasing out their corporate income taxes. South Dakota, another economically competitive state, has no corporate income tax. And I would just like to add that the opportunity cost is hard to measure of what could have occurred in the last decade for economic growth or companies coming into the state that didn't because we have a high corporate income tax. So that completes my prepared comments. We do have some slides that we would like to run through, Mr. Chair. I will have Kendra run through those if we can.
Sure. Go right ahead.
Through the chair, this is Kendra, staff representative of Carpenter. I will begin. So the corporate income tax, Alaska levies the corporate income tax on certain corporations doing business in the state under Alaska Statute 43.19 and 43.20. Corporate tax rates are graduated with a maximum rate of 9.4% applying to Alaska taxable income above $2,222 million. As corporations and limited liability companies, LLCs that file federally as partnerships are generally exempt from Alaska's corporate income tax. A non-oil and gas corporation computes its tax liability based on the federal taxable income of its Water's Edge combined report, a measure of income earned in the United States. With Alaska adjustments, for example, Alaska tax code allows special treatment for certain dividends and royalties received from foreign corporations. U.S. income is apportioned to Alaska based on three factors: sales, property, and payroll. Alaska's taxable income is determined by applying the apportionment factor to the corporation's modified federal taxable income. Corporate income tax for oil and gas corporations is calculated differently and reported separately in Chapter 6. Generally, a corporation is subject to tax on its current year Alaska taxable income, and any net operating losses may be carried forward indefinitely to offset future tax liabilities. However, as part of the Federal CARES Act passed in 2020, corporations could carry back net operation losses from tax year 2018, 2019, and 2020, up to 5 years, and receive funds for previous federal taxes paid. Alaska adopts most provisions of the Federal Corporate Income Tax Code by referencing, including the provisions allowing the 5-year carryback for net operating losses from tax year 2018, 2019, and 2020. Thus, this carryback provision applied to Alaska corporate income tax as well for tax years 2021 and beyond. Corporations are once again only able to carry forward net operating losses. The next slide here. So this is the non-oil revenue from current corporate income tax. So you see the fiscal year 2024 is $125 million. Next slide. Yep, there you go. So as you'll see here, the petroleum corporate income tax received for the fiscal year 2024 forecast is around $320 million. So, as you can see, this is the current law as Alaska Statute 43.20.11, Section E. So, currently, this is how it goes right now. And as you can see, it's very complex. Alaska currently has the fourth highest tax rate and the highest graduation of rates in the nation. Only New Jersey, Minnesota, and Illinois have higher rates. This bill would reduce Alaska's rates to a single 2% rate and the lowest rate in the nation for states with corporate taxes. For now, North Carolina currently has the lowest CIT rate at 2.5, which they will phase out by 2023.
Mr. Chairman?
2030, sorry.
Go ahead, Representative
Grohl. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for the bill sponsor. If we could go back a slide or two slides, the one that showed the rates that are shown in this graphic are different from the ones that are shown in the bill under existing law. The rates shown in the graphic show a maximum rate of 90,000 or more, but in the bill it's shown that the rates go up to 222,000 or more.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. We seem to have a slide out of order or something here. I'll have to take a look at that and figure out where the... Thank you for catching that. But you're right, the two do not match.
We can correct that slide and get that back to you guys.
Okay, moving on.
All right. How high are corporate income tax rates in your state? As you can see, Alaska is in the red, and you can notice the gray is no taxes, and then gradually gets up to the red. Alaska is one of the highest. It's the top four in the nation for the highest tax, corporate tax rates. Graduated corporate rates are inequitable. That is, the size of a corporation bears no necessary relation to the income levels of the owners. Low-income corporations may be owned by individuals with high incomes, and high-income corporations may be owned by individuals with low incomes. A single-rate system minimizes the incentive for firms to engage in economically wasteful tax planning to mitigate the damage of higher marginal tax rate that some states levy as taxable income rises. So this bill right here, it proposed law at Alaska Statute 43.20.11e, this is what this bill would do. So as you notice from the last slide, it's very complex. This would make it less than $25,000 would be zero, taxed at zero, and anything over $25,000 would be at 2% of taxable income. So the income, so this is the, just want to point out that the, this bill does not change the income tax education credit. This is the current statute. So why? Alaska's economy is lagging that of the nation. Our GDP economic growth over the past decade has been the worst in the country. 65,000 more people have left Alaska than moved from here. Other states over the decade in our modern economy, people are mobile and will move for employment opportunities. The House Ways and Means Committee has been tasked with improving Alaska's economy and reducing the cost of doing business in Alaska. And improving the cost of doing a business in Alaska is a good place to start. So as you see, Alaska's economic report card has failing grades. Our GDP is the worst in the nation. This slide shows that the domestic migration has been people are leaving Alaska. Go to the next slide. Corporate income taxes are levied in 44 states, and 29 states have single-rate corporate tax systems. While often thought of as a major tax type, state corporate income tax accounted for an average of just over 7% of state tax collections and 4% of state general revenues in fiscal year 2021. And while these figures are not high, they represent a substantial increase over prior years and are among the reasons corporations decide where to conduct business. Corporate income taxes accounted for 2.26% of general revenue in fiscal year 2020. So this slide shows how high our corporate income tax rates are, and ours is at 9.4%. So people pay all taxes. When the government levies a tax on a corporation, the corporation is more like a tax collector than a taxpayer. The burden of the tax ultimately falls on people, the owners, customers, or workers of the corporations. The corporate income tax is popular in part because it appears to be paid by rich corporations, yet those who bear the ultimate burden of the tax, the customers and workers of corporations, are often not rich. If the true incidence of the corporate tax were more widely known, this tax might be less popular among voters. A low flat rate corporate tax will significantly level the playing field between C-corps and S-corps and limited liability companies. Low corporate tax rates have been proven to increase productivity, which leads to improved economic output for the state. As time goes on, the corporate income tax will mean that a business hires fewer workers and or moves the business out of state. Because the income tax has made doing business in the state prohibitively high. As businesses leave the state, income tax revenues decreases in the years that follow. That makes the revenue volatility for income taxes relatively high compared to that of sales and use taxes. Corporate income taxes are volatile. As they are taxes on production, when corporate income taxes get high enough, the business will produce less in that state. This is because the business, as opposed to the customers, are the less elastic side of the market. Customers, the more elastic side of the market, may decide to no longer buy from the business at the higher price. Elasticity also increases the more time passes after a price change. So in this figure, you can see the corporate income tax is the most volatile. It kind of goes everywhere. And this slide shows the all states of the United States.
All states?
Yep. So this is average of, or the what has happened throughout the U.S. Economically competitive states like North Carolina have been reducing rates, flattening brackets, or phasing out their corporate taxes. South Dakota has no corporate tax. Why? Because taxes have economic consequences. So the next group of slides show what positive impacts following the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. So I'll just kind of slide through these fairly fast.
Sure. Representative, okay.
Well, I think it's worth pointing out. Can we go back to the last slide? Thank you, through the chair. So South Dakota has no corporate tax at all, but as we saw in a previous presentation analysis last week, they've got a pretty darn healthy sales tax that brings in, like, I can't remember the number, it's like $1.8 billion or something, because they tax they tax services, they tax goods, they tax using the sales tax. Everybody remember that? So, I don't know, Representative Carpenter, I just want to point that out, I guess, that, okay, they don't have a corporate income tax, but they survive by having a really healthy sales tax.
I think right. This is, through the chair to Representative McKay. Strange to be on this side of the dialogue here. I think this draws a point exactly to where we find ourselves today in Ways and Means, talking about a fiscal package that would reorder the way we think about state finances and revenue generation for the state government. So if we're looking at the lens, like we talked about in the previous presentation, about how to grow economic activity in the state, and our corporate income tax policy is a drain or a hurdle to have to get over for income to come into the state or investment dollars to come into the state, then a complete package that addresses that and shifts the burden of the tax to a broader economic factor, the spending of money within the state, both by residents and non-residents, then you're reordering the way that the state is receiving money in a way that improves your ability to grow the economy. So as the economy, the non-government economy grows with a sales tax, then the state revenue would increase. Currently, if our non-oil economy grows, another Walmart comes in and there's more revenue. If they're not paying a corporate income tax, there is no connection to the state revenue. So a broad-based tax and reducing the corporate income tax would have the net effect of making it a more advantageous place to invest your dollars, and that would help us grow our economy. And so, as I've said before, I'm not presenting a bill, or I am presenting a bill today that is a corporate income tax bill. It's a reduction of a corporate income tax rate. But I'm presenting it in the context of a fiscal plan that does more than just one thing, because we're talking about a broad solution. So I hope that addresses your question.
Yeah.
kind of just want to point that out. It's interesting that we mentioned South Dakota. Saw it in a previous analysis.
Yes, and through the chair, I think we will see a presentation on a sales tax here shortly.
So I have a question, and maybe this will help, but a few slides back, and you don't have to go there, but you mentioned that at the end of the day, the people pay the tax. At the end of the day, if it's a corporate income tax and it's too high, we pay one way or the other. We either pay because the corporation won't come to Alaska because the corporate income tax is too high, and so we don't have jobs, we don't have the products that they produce, we don't have the sort of uptick in economy, or we can lower the corporate tax, the businesses and the corporations can come to the state of Alaska, they can grow their business, they can have jobs and everything else that helps to sort of float the economy, and we're going to pay sales tax like South Dakota does to take up the difference. Or I guess what I'm trying to do is highlight what happens in South Dakota is somebody's got to pay somewhere. And that's maybe, I don't know, maybe that helps to define it a little bit.
I'm not sure if there's a question there, Mr. Chair, but I guess the feedback that I would give is that at the end of the day, it is the consumer that pays the tax. Whether it's a corporate tax, whether it's a sales tax or an income tax, it's the consumer that's going to pay that tax. So that's all of us, all of us. So the corporate income tax in the state of Alaska may not be a direct tax on me. Like I'm not writing a check or I'm not paying it when I go to a point of sale. But it is a tax that somebody within the state is paying because the consumer is the one that pays it.
Thank you, through the chair. I was actually almost like going to call on you that let me speak because you're normally right next to me. Thank you, and through the chair. So to bring back your point, Representative McCabe, it's true because even if we entice people or they're here, corporations if it's too high, and I think this is to validate your point, is it's still going to get passed down to us. So do we want them here at a lower rate, or do we just say, okay, we can do a higher rate, but it's all going to come down to when you tax the corporations, they're going to have to roll it down to us as the consumers. So we have to be really wise on how we do this. So
I would agree with that, and I would just argue that we use the word sin tax.
Yes.
SIN tax for a reason.
Yes.
There's a theory out there that says if you tax what you don't want, you will get less of it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so if we're taxing corporate investment in the state, people coming in or corporations coming in and doing business in the state, then we're taxing it at a very high rate, then we're likely to get less of that. And if that's what we really want to encourage in the state, then we should reduce that tax and reap the benefit, which is increased activity in that regard. Well, if you're going to replace that tax burden with a broad-based tax of some kind, then you don't want to replace it with a tax that is so narrow that it negatively impacts that economic growth. So to Representative McKay's point, if you're going to talk about reducing a corporate income tax and replacing some of that with a broad tax that is more broadly distributed across the economy than just on the corporate interest that could be investing in the economy, so it's a broad base on the population, then there's a corresponding positive to that because there's economic activity possible that wasn't there before.
Follow up. Thank you for turning my question or my comment into a question. I appreciate it. Thank you, Chair.
So I have another question. So our corporate, when we tax our corporations, we tax them on their complete income, even if they're doing business in another state, if I remember right. So if there's a corporation like, say, Walmart, do we only tax them corporately on what they make in Alaska, or do we tax them for their total, what they totally make worldwide? Or
no, I don't think we tax them on, to the chair, I don't think we tax them on their entire worldwide if they're an international corporation. We're not taxing them on the whole international total. It's just on what they're producing within the state. However, that's being figured out. We know what the dollar figure is that the state has been making on the corporate tax, and we know that reducing it will reduce both the burden to the corporation and the revenue to the state. And so it has a corresponding positive impact on the amount of capital that the company has to invest in economic growth for that company.
Great. Thank you.
I would just also like to say, Mr. Chair, that DOR, the Department of Revenue, is online as well, and they might be better able to answer that question or answer it in a better way than I did if you want them to respond.
That's okay. It was sort of a – I think I already knew the answer to that, so go ahead and move on.
Okay.
Representative Gray.
Thank you, Chair. I was just looking at the GDP growth for 2021 as reported in Forbes last year. It ranked the 50 states. Alaska was last. South Dakota was number 47. So I was curious if that is our goal, is to try to get to 47.
If we were, through the chair, Representative Gray, if we were dead last and we improved by one, we're at least improving, and that would be headed in the right direction. It would not be my goal to set my sight at let's just move 3 percentage points up, but I am looking for some positive direction because the status quo doesn't seem to be getting us where we want to go.
Okay, continue.
As I said, next few slides are just showing what the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. So I'm just going to quickly go through these next few. So this one is GDP growth is much higher than in Europe. So this kind of shows how what happened after 2017. And this one is the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, how it's getting improved. This one, you can see the poverty rate and the U.S. median income went down. And then also, as you see, the black unemployment went down. And this is the U.S. real median income. It went up. And then the Hispanic and Latina unemployment rates went down. The U.S. unemployment as a whole went down after 2017. And so did the high school diploma unemployment rates. The government receipts taxes have consequences. So as you see, after 2017, you can see that the we made more money, basically. So as you see, the OECD equal weighted average corporate tax rate, as it went down, but the OECD corporate tax revenue percentage of the GDP went up. So the 6-month real GDP growth rates annualized Reagan and Obama comparatively. Then, as you see here, this is our last slide. We want Alaska to be yellow. We want it to be not red. So this is what the HB 109 is intending to do or help.
Representative Girl.
Thank you, Chair. I wanted to ask just a few questions because you're making comparisons between Alaska's tax brackets and the corporate income tax in other states. Let's just say there are two businesses. They both make $10,000 in profit. One's located in Hawaii and which in Alaska. Under current law, which one would pay less in corporate income taxes?
I'm looking to see what the corporate income tax rate is on the chart here, which is, says 6.4% for Hawaii. And I know that the top bracket is in Alaska, is 9%. So the 10,000 at the 10,000 range, I can figure that out for the state of Alaska, but I'm not sure what the graduation is in the state of Hawaii. Can you help me out with that?
Yeah, the Alaska be zero, and Hawaii, they pay 440. So it'd be lower taxes in Alaska under the current regime.
Okay. I'm going to have to take your word for it because I don't know what Hawaii.
And that's also true Alaska versus Utah. Then if you then let's go to $60,000 and more, you know, profitable business. Alaska pay about half the taxes as in North Carolina, the one that you offered. I'm just saying that the brackets, there's some Alaska's brackets are not highest at every level in terms of under current law, and so I do want to get that picture across. We could go all the way up. My staff did this in apparently 2 hours. Let's go all the way to a business that makes $700,000 in Alaska and one that makes the same in Iowa. And then in Alaska, the taxes would still be lower than in Iowa at $700,000 under current law. So I want to get across a picture of the tax brackets in Alaska. And Mr. Chair, if I could, I could ask one additional question. It's a little different one. There's this fiscal note. I've been looking at, I'm sort of chronologically advantaged, as sometimes some of my colleagues, like Mr. Craig, will point out. I've been looking at fiscal notes in the state of Alaska's legislature for more than 40 years. I don't know if I've ever seen one that has this kind of loss of revenues, and I just wanted to have you address that. I mean, this appears to be well over adding the much more than 25% to the deficit, and it'd just be great to hear you talk about that. Good.
Okay. We are prepared to address the fiscal notes. If I might, Mr. Chair, address, I'm not sure if there were questions. I'd be totally willing to have a conversation about other states' brackets. We didn't prepare a presentation for and don't have the data to compare that right now, but we can if that's something the committee wants to do. Whether companies at different income ranges are paying less than 9% corporate income tax rate, there are companies within the state of Alaska who are paying the 9% rate. And it is the largest of the corporations that have that fit into that that range. As a matter of fact, I think I've got, if you don't mind for a second, I've got some information here to speak specifically to that. So we've got roughly from the presentation from Department of Revenue under previous, we've got 20,000 taxpayers in 2022, 20,152 from the corporate income tax. And that's throughout the different ranges of our tax bracket. The point is of reducing that tax bracket from the 9% down to 2 is not a conversation about which companies are paying what rates within the brackets or how many are paying in a particular bracket. The point is that all companies are impacted and the amount that they're paying is reduced down to a flat 2%. So it benefits all of the companies except those that maybe were paying 2% in the beginning, right? So it isn't, in my mind, an argument about which bracket or how many people or how much money, how many corporations are paying in which bracket or how much money you're raising in each bracket. We do know that it's a reduction of somewhere around $300 million for this proposed fiscal year. And so that is something that we have to grapple with, right? Let's go to move to the fiscal. Mr. Chair. Okay, let's see. The fiscal note that is before us here, which is for the Department of Revenue and the appropriations of taxation and treasury, and the component OMB component number is 2476. And that is compared to the other one that is both 2476. Are they both the same?
Yes.
Okay. All right, so the fiscal year 24 appropriation column, which is the first column on the left-hand side, is for $169 million reduction from the budget. The out years, starting in fiscal year 25, is a $328 million reduction in revenue to the state. That is what we would have to grapple with if we reduce the corporate income tax. So in the current thinking of the annual budget process where we're trying to balance the budget, the question is, why would you want to do something like this, right? So the question is, which lens are you looking at life through? And the question is, do we want to incentivize economic growth or not? And if we're looking at a fiscal package that says we reduce taxes in one area and pick up taxes in a different area, and that has a corresponding positive impact on economic growth, then that's why we would do it. Obviously, if we're going to do only a corporate income tax reduction, which is not what I'm presenting as a alternative to the legislature, then we would be creating a bigger problem for ourselves because our deficit would grow. And without a corresponding solution to that deficit, then we're just creating a bigger problem for ourselves. And that's not what I'm suggesting. I am suggesting that if we drop the corporate income tax and we have economic growth, then into the future, 5-10 years, whatever, we're going to see a corresponding positive impact to our state economy because of that action.
So let me ask you this, Representative Carpenter. Fiscal notes pretty much show what's going to happen right now and what's going to happen next year and what's going to happen in the following year without any outside intervention, such as new companies coming in, new companies saying, woohoo, we've always wanted to do business in Alaska. Now that the corporate income tax rate is down, we can find our way, find our path forward, because we're going to save 7%. And so, but you can't really show that in a fiscal note, right? I mean, fiscal notes are pretty much cut and dried, you know, with the collars and controls and A to B equals C, but it doesn't show sort of the what economists might call a hidden benefit or even the hidden cost. It's just what it is without.
Mr. Chair, you're right. It's just in numbers, and I'm not used to being on this side of the table here. I realize that I'm speaking through a fiscal note when I've got some subject matter experts on the phone here from Department of Revenue that would be able to speak to it as well. But I would like to point out, and they can correct me if I'm wrong here, but to your point, the change between the reduction in revenue from fiscal year 25 to 26 to 27, for example, is going from $328 million to $333 million to $350 million, which seems like a known decrease, and it's predictable. But as we saw on the slide before, the corporate income tax rate is an unpredictable. It's a very volatile reduction, so we don't really know that's what's going to happen. These fat figures are just being taking the governor's 10-year plan or the Department of Revenue's 10-year plan and saying we're just picking a number that says we're going to have X number of growth in revenue from a corporate income tax over the next 10 years. And then we plug that in here to say that growth isn't going to happen because you've dropped the tax rate. And that's why it shows that number. It's just a swag, scientific, wild guess, as best we can do. And I would ask Mr. Chair if DOR could speak to the fiscal note. They might correct me if I was wrong.
Sure. So who's going to make me stand up and go over here and look at you?
You can sit in my chair.
So it looks like from the, who would you want, Department of Revenue, Mr. or Spanos?
That will work.
Okay. Brandon Spanos. Did you hear the question, Mr. Spanos? Can you hear me?
I can, yes. For the record, this is Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director with the Tax Division. And I did prepare the fiscal note. Our economists did the analysis of the revenue impact. And I'll speak to that. The starting point for that revenue impact was the revenue sources book, the spring forecast. And so in that RSB, there are two lines, one for corporate income tax, non-oil and gas, and one for corporate income tax, oil and gas companies. They applied the rate from the bill, which would be 2% for anyone making over $49,000 in taxable income, $25,000 in taxable income. The 2% would be applied to all, and the graduated rates would go away. That is the analysis that was done to determine the tax impact or the revenue impact. And the reason you see that it goes up each year is the RSB shows growth in the corporate income tax under the current statutes, and this would be a reduction in those.
Thank you for that. So, Mr. Spanos, it's Representative McCabe. So, as I mentioned, and maybe this is a better way to put it, this fiscal note assumes no new corporations entering the market or entering Alaska. It just assumes a flat sort of level playing field with nobody new being enticed to come into our state and do business, correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We didn't analyze the economic impact of new companies coming in because of a lower tax rate.
So, follow up here, is that even possible? I mean, is there some sort of Monte Carlo type of test we can do on that, or maybe examples from other states that have done this, or are we just kind of left wondering?
So, Mr. Chair, certainly anything's possible. We would need to know the assumptions. We have contracted with a company, Chainbridge, to do some analysis for us in the past, and there is a cost associated with that. So, assuming we have the budget, we could request them to do an analysis. First we'd have to speak with them to see if they have the expertise to do that and determine that. But like you mentioned, another option that we could do is look at other states that have reduced their rate recently and see what the tax effects are. Now, of course, there's a lot of moving factors, so it is a complicated question. I'm not an economist, and I don't want to speak on behalf of our economics team. I can certainly ask them and get back to you.
We might have a way forward to model that, Mr. Chair, here in the near future.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Spanos. I won't encumber Representative Carpenter's office account with a request for economic modeling at this time. So, Representative Gray.
Thank you, Chair. So we talked about how about $320 billion of the corporate income tax comes from oil and gas currently. It was on your slide. You don't have to find it, but...
$320 million.
Yes. It's late. So $320 million. About 70%. 70% of our corporate income tax comes from oil. So I guess the question is it your, I guess, to use your words, the lens that if we drastically cut that revenue that we're getting from oil, that we will encourage GDP growth?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, and this is Representative Carpenter, for the record. So, is your question if an oil company
I want to leave
pays less in corporate tax, are they going to have, or are we going to see economic growth from that in the oil and gas sector? Is that the question you're asking?
Well, I formed a new question,
okay,
which is there a mechanism for us to, because it seems like we would want other companies to come in. That this might be me, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that we are hoping that other companies will come to Alaska and set up shop here. Well, maybe we can lower the corporate income tax for everyone else, but we could keep that $320 million because we don't change the corporate income tax for oil and gas. I mean, that's I'm just trying to fix the fiscal note.
Through the chair to Representative Gray, this is Representative Carpenter for the record. To the extent that the legislature can set the tax rates at whatever we want to and we're allowed to by law, then that is something that we could consider. I'm not suggesting that it is what I want, but it is something that might be possible. Now, I don't know whether that's fair to single out specific corporations and say you have to pay a tax, but these corporations don't over here. There might be other ways to get at what you're discussing, such as a restructuring of the way we do per barrel tax credits, for example. So if you have a decrease in the corporate income tax rate, but a increase in the decrease in the per barrel tax credit, and so you see you have just a leveling of the bubble, if you will, and there's a net zero change to the revenue generated, then that might be an option. What I want to get at more than anything, because I recognize that our oil and gas sector is challenged with growth in the state of Alaska, and I think that's going to be with us for the foreseeable future. So growing our non-oil private sector economy is what I'm really after and what I think would be in the Alaskans' best interest. If you take into consideration that most people don't work in the oil industry, most people work in the non-oil private sector, that's where the opportunity is that most Alaskans are going to benefit from. So whatever we're doing to encourage growth in that area is where I would like to focus. I also recognize that there are a significant number of Alaskans that work in the oil and gas industry, and I don't want to penalize the oil and gas industry because we're trying to grow another portion of our state, another portion of our state's economy. So to that extent, I am not interested in singling out the oil industry to pay any more in taxes because they are already, in my opinion, heavily taxed.
Follow up. So I just looking at this one, and I've talked about California before, and I only use California as an example because that is a state that I think most people would agree is a high tax state. Mm-hmm. And that 8.84% is their, I Googled it, their flat rate. So they charge every company that. So I'm not doing the math, but I would say if they're charging everyone 8.84 and we have sort of a graded one, they're kind of on, we're a little bit higher for our more profitable companies. But, and that Forbes article that I made reference to earlier where South Dakota was number 47. California was number 3 for GDP growth that year. When you look back 5 years, California was number 4 for GDP growth, where Alaska was 51. If we go back and look at 10 years, California was number 3 for best GDP growth, and Alaska was 51. And I just bring that up as an example that, at least in the case of California, it's a high tax state that manages to still be in the top 5 for GDP growth, even when we go out a decade.
And through the chair to Representative Gray, so Representative Carpenter for the record. And I don't have the numbers that you have sitting in front of me, so I'm not going to dispute them. What I would say is talking about a corporate income tax reduction as being one part of a plan. Alaska has some other disadvantages that California has advantages to, and namely cost of electricity being one of them. And so when we're talking about economic growth within the state of Alaska, it's not just about reducing the corporate income tax rate or restructuring the revenue stream that the state has. It's also in providing economic activity with a reduction of the cost of energy. And so if we're comparing just the tax policy, then I'm not sure where the average would fall within the state of Alaska, you know. If you're making $90,000 or more in taxable income, you're at the 9.4% rate. If you're $50,000 but less than $60,000, you're at the 6% rate. I don't know what the average is of what the 20,000 Alaskan corporations pay, but the point would be there's more than one thing to compare California's growth or lack thereof. I'm not sure where they're at right now, but I know that there's a mass exodus of people from California over the last few years. And so that might indicate less economic activity in the state of California going into the future. I don't know. I'm not talking about California today. I'm talking about the state of Alaska. So
there's there's two more questions. We're at the top of the hour. So we would be normally, I'll defer to the committee if you want to hang around and get a few more questions answered. I don't think there's anybody in the room after us. So, Representative Groh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is Mr. Spanos still there?
Mr. Spanos, are you still online?
Oh, Yep, I am. Sorry for the delay.
Did I hear something?
Yes, I am still online.
Mr. Spanos, we've had some discussions here about possible companies that would be attracted to Alaska by a lower corporate income tax. I've met with a number of businessmen and read some of the literature. Isn't it true that there are a number of factors that help the corporations decide where they're going to locate, including whether they're good schools and good roads, good public safety, in terms of corporate location decisions?
So through the chair, Representative Groh, I'd say I'm not qualified to answer that. I'm a tax administrator, so I can answer questions about the tax structure itself, but as far as what might entice a company to come to Alaska, I would say I'm not qualified to answer.
Okay. I guess it wouldn't follow up, but I asked the chair. We could always speculate about, we can always speculate about what effects could have, you know, a various tax change could have. And I am concerned, and I said, and I understand you said there would be some economic modeling, that we're making a big change here, you know, giving away more than $300 million in tax revenue, as you've noted with this fiscal note, on a full year basis. And I just think it'd be useful to make sure that we had a better understanding of how that would work in terms of making such a major decision. And like you said, raising the deficit by more than 25% if we did this by itself.
Through the chair, Representative Groh, this is Representative Carpenter. And I'm not suggesting, or by bringing this bill forward, I'm not suggesting that we give away $300 million in tax revenue. That is not at all what I'm suggesting. I can only talk about one bill at a time sitting here right now. And so I have said that a corporate income tax reduction would have a corresponding impact to our private sector economy that I think Alaskans would like to see happen, and that is in our best interest moving forward to stimulate growth. We obviously need to have a conversation about what the additional deficit, how to fill that, and that will be have to be a conversation for another day with another revenue measure or some other fiscal policy that helps with that, overcome that hurdle, right?
Thank you.
Okay, well, thanks for presenting HB 109 to the committee. We'll be holding this bill over to bring up at a later date, and I believe this concludes our business for today. So seeing no other business before the committee, I'll take the great liberty and adjourn this committee. Let the record reflect that the time is 8:04 p.m.